don't much care whether we learn from them or not. They don't seem to work at trying to missionize us. They're very glad to talk to us about what they have on their minds, but don't try to impose on us in any way. As with other religions, it has a great deal to do with health. Maybe our modern religions don't have as much to do with health as primitive Christianity did, and many other religions deal with the things that you don't understand. Supernatural. If you don't know how to cure diseases, it becomes part of the healing of part of religion. Harmony in general. The harmony of your physical being, the harmony of your relations with other people, and the harmony of your relations with nature, which is much more emphasized in American Indian religions than it is with us. We have the concept of loving God and loving our neighbor as ourselves, but Indians very much emphasize loving God's creation too. Love all nature, the wind, the waters, the rocks, the trees, animals, everything else. So Indians feel very much related. Being related is very important to an Indian. The worst thing an Indian can say about another Indian is he looks as though he didn't have any relatives. There's some other differences that might be pointed out, some that Vine Deloria brings out in his book God is Red, which is laid on the table there. He develops the theme that Christianity is very time-oriented and Indian religions are very place-oriented. We may have said that Indians were nomads sometimes, but they weren't anywhere near as much nomads as we are. We're moving around all the time. They may have lived in the mountains in the summertime and down in the valleys in the wintertime or something like that, but in the same terrain, and then they would just oscillate back and forth with the seasons or whatever the activities, the hunting or farming or whatever it was of that appropriate to that part of the year. But the place, and Indians had been very stable, say up to 300 or 400 years ago when we started pushing them around. They had had 10,000 or 30,000 years to get adjusted to this continent, and they had pretty well worked out their problems of whose terrain, whose territory was whose. So that, and they had buried many generations of their ancestors were buried in the land they lived on, and they felt very much rooted there in a way that we do not. And they point out to us that they pity us. So we are an unrooted people. We don't really feel we belong anywhere. And an Indian really belongs. He's so devoted to, so loyal to, well, he's so much a part of his community. Whereas we are individuals. And that is a theme that Vine Deloria develops, that the Christianity has, through our myths and our legends, the concept of the Garden of Eden and the original sin and being forced to live in this veil of tears, and then through vicarious atonement, the death of Jesus, we can find salvation, and if we're obedient, then we go on to eternal life. Indians believed in eternity, but they didn't believe in this kind of an individual salvation. They believed that eternity was circular, so to speak. It was a cycle. And you lived a life, and then you are gone. But you hand on. It's the continuity, the eternal existence of the community that's important to Indian philosophy, Indian religion, Indian culture. That's the all-important thing. I remember asking Continetta Horn one time, she was giving a lecture at Haverford, asking her what it was that Indians were most aspired to, what they were trying to achieve, what they wished for. And she said, "We're not trying to achieve anything. We just want you to stop robbing us and pushing us around and cheating us and leave us alone, and we want to survive." They're not trying to get rich. They're not trying to get famous by building empires. They want to survive. They want their community to survive. not necessarily the individual. The individual is expendable, but the survival of the community is the all-important thing. I remember at a work camp we had in Cuba, New Mexico, the Catholic priest there, we invited him to dinner one night, and he said that this was the first time in, I think, 2 years that he'd been in that village that anybody had invited him to a meal. He hated that town of Cuba, New Mexico. He was really living in hell because, he said, I want to go to heaven. And if I am obedient, I will go to heaven. And it just seemed to me to be such a shame that a man was living his life in hell because he had some feeling that by doing so, he was going to go to heaven. Indian doesn't feel that way. He's in heaven right now. William Bacon Evans used to say, white man always getting ready to live. Indian, he lives all the time. They don't get rich. They don't get powerful. But to have a harmonious community is really everything. They didn't care much about property. That was one of the big problems we've had, relations between whites and Indians. The Indian didn't own the land. Therefore, if the white man wanted to come and borrow some or use some of it along with him, that was okay. The Indian wasn't going to chase the white man off. He didn't realize the white man was going to chase him off. That was a complete misunderstanding of what property is in our Western concepts and Indian concepts. William Penn commented about the Indians, that if you give an Indian a coat, he'll give it to somebody else the next day. He'll give it to somebody else the next day. It floats all around the community. He doesn't feel obligated to the person who gave it to him. There's a term we call an Indian giver, which I think in our culture means a person who gives you something and wants it back again. That isn't true of an Indian at all. The thing that's true about an Indian, if you give an Indian something, he is not obligated to you for having received it from you. You wanted to give it to him, that's fine. Gives you the pleasure of giving it, gives him the pleasure of receiving it, then he also has the pleasure of giving it. You're not his slave. In fact, I've heard an Indian say, gift giving makes a slave of a person. And they are not going to be anybody's slave. Indian is a free man and he's an individual in a way, but his value, virtue, his value is in his value to his group and his belonging to his group rather than to him as an individual. Individual salvation doesn't mean anything to an Indian.
Ted?
Yes?
Didn't the Indians just quarrel among themselves about how the ransom money was going to be divided among them?
Well, all sorts of things happened after the contact, after white people came in, after it became commercialized. Indians who had related very well to their environment in a good ecology way, a harmonious way, praying to the spirit of the animal that they were going to kill and that sort of thing, so that they did not destroy. And nevertheless, when it came to the beaver trade, and there was money in it, and there were material things to be had by it, and power to be had by it, and when they were being shot at by the white people, they were glad to get guns and have guns to shoot at their enemies too. Things changed a little bit after the contact. So I wouldn't say that all was paradise before the coming of the white man, and there certainly, but I do think that having had 10 or 20,000 years in an unchanging technology, people begin to get their problems solved. And I think Indian life was a very harmonious life before contact. Now, I'll admit that Navajo came in somewhat later than some others, and I think they were an intrusive force that they used their elbows to get some room, and so there was some hostility when the Navajo came in. But then that began to settle down, too. It hadn't quite settled down yet. There's still dissidence between the Navajo and the Hopi and their neighbors. But with an unchanging technology, people begin to solve their problems, and we all aspire toward peace. Peace pipe has a very significant part of Indian religion. It's very symbolic. It has mineral matter, has wood, has leather, four legs, feathers of the tooth of the winged, some wampum of marine life, has some tobacco, some vegetation which is burned, which has heat, practically has life to it, and the smoke has aroma. You see it looks like a spirit rising And it so integrates so many things of the universe. And then the way it's used, it's presented to Father the sky, to Mother the earth, and to the four directions, each of the four directions having a symbolic meaning in their legends and their myths of the vicissitudes of life, but different times of the year, death, earth, in the four directions, and then presented to oneself. And then to everybody present, everybody taking a couple puffs, goes around the circle, really integrates people, ties people together in a relationship that is much more meaningful than putting your hand on the Bible or something that we, or take communion, which is, although the word communion sounds as though it's communal, it's very much more of an individualistic thing than smoking the peace pipe. This really integrates everybody present with all of one's surroundings and all the concepts of the universe. And after having done that, then any agreements reached are reached in great sincerity. Nothing is done lightly or deceitfully after having integrated those present in that way. So I think it's a portable oil altar. It's one of the greatest symbolic things that I think that mankind has come up with for good community relations. Very recently, Dan Bassick here at Pendle Hill put together a publication about Aldous Huxley and friends, which doesn't mention Indians, but it seems so related to Indians to me as I read it. Of all Christian sects in the 17th century, the Quakers were the least obsessed with history. As I just said, Indians are too. The least addicted to the idolatry of things in time. It goes on. Moreover, their eternity philosophy preserved them from the materialistic apocalypticism of that progress worship which in recent times has justified every kind of iniquity from war and revolution to sweated labor, slavery, and exploitation of savages and children. It justified them on the ground that the supreme good is in future time and that any temporal means, however intrinsically horrible, may be used to achieve that good. Because Quaker theology was a form of eternity philosophy, Quaker political theory rejected war and persecution as means to ideal ends, denounced slavery, and proclaimed racial equality. I think that's just so true of Indians. They don't have this feeling of a time linear history of progress towards some future good. It's a present harmony in the present cycle. I'm frequently simply horrified by some people who think that they are preordained to be saved, who know that they are saved. And I think it's some of the most dangerous things around to have people like that who don't give a damn about the world because they know they're going to heaven. And what they're going to do to the rest of us, I don't know, because I think they're just a terrible threat. And he goes on, also speaking about the relation between theology and corporal punishment in childhood. I have a theory that wherever little boys and girls are systematically flagellated, the victims grow up to think of God as wholly other. Wherever, on the contrary, children are brought up without being subjected to physical violence, God is immanent. And look at the Quakers. They were heretical enough to believe in the inner life. And what happened? They gave up beating their children and were the first Christian denomination to protest against the institution of slavery. Well, Indians don't beat their children. They're horrified at us to beat children. Well, that's part of your religion, part of your culture, what it is. It's all one piece. Much more could be said, but we have a short evening. I want to say a little bit about Indian art. And again, as with anybody else, art is a personal expression, aesthetically pleasing, makes life more pleasant, but it's almost always utilitarian. It's likely to be artifacts, you might say, and crafts, as utilitarian things like dishes and spoons and clothing and housing, footwear, tools, They didn't have permanent buildings, generally speaking. Some of the Pueblos did, but so many of the Indians moved a bit that they didn't have oil paintings on the walls or encumbered with statuary or that sort of thing. Not fine art the way we do it. But the things that they used, they liked to have them beautiful as much as anybody does. And they used them to identify themselves. That is a person's shield or the figures on a teepee or part of your clothing would identify who you are. You see today many Indians who wear some sort of a slide tie or something of the sort with a beaver on it or a turtle on it or a wolf on it. You know what clan they belong to. And other people would have their own personal identification, a warrior with his shield. The shield wasn't a shield that would stop bullets or even arrows, but told who you were. More like a pennant would or a flag. And totem poles. Identify the family that lived there, maybe tell something about their history. So art was used to tell the story to an illiterate people, just as much of the painting of our culture of the Middle Ages, when people didn't read, they learned the biblical stories through painting. And so Indians similarly, by symbols, told something of their legends or gave a picture that could be explained to the young people as to what their legends were. I might say that the dance was very important to Indians, both in religion and as an art, in a way that is not to the same extent with us. It is with us, but I wouldn't say it doesn't permeate our society the way it does with Indians. They don't dance just for the tourists. They may dance for the tourists. They're paid too sometimes. But they would dance if there weren't any tourists around. Whenever Indians go anyplace, they take their costumes and their drums and are sure to spend the rest of the night after a conference in dancing and in religious dancing, expressing themselves religiously by the dance. They really put themselves into a community expression that I think we ought to emulate. It does something to a community to see three generations or four generations doing the same thing because they want to be part of that community. There's quite a lot of American Indian art active at the moment. Maybe the center of it would be the Institute of American Indian Art at Santa Fe, which is a Bureau of Indian Affairs institution, high school grade, maybe a little bit of junior college, with instruction opportunities in just about anything that you could call art, which would include dance and poetry, and drama, creative writing, as well as sculpture and silver work and basket work and painting, and even welding and anything, whether it be traditional or whether it be modern. Very, very interesting institution, and a lot of things are coming from there. And there are quite a number of other artists that are active. There are shows frequently. There's one starting about now at the Red Cloud Indian School at Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Contemporary American Indian art. At the Gilcrease Museum and the Philbrook Museum in Tulsa, there are good exhibits of Indian things and other things too. And Willow Rock in Oklahoma. High Museum, that's the Museum of the American Indian on Broadway, 155th Street in New York, have a lot of things that I don't suppose that they would, that they weren't produced as, yes, they were produced as works of art too. I'll show you a lot of them. Clothing and things like that are beautiful. It isn't, didn't fine art, say, like a rectangular painting to put on the wall. Just a little bit about literature. Of course, Indians were not illiterate people. They had pictographs. Petroglyphs, images that would be drawn on buffalo skins or teepees or clothing. Later, of course, the Cherokee, when they saw that white people could write things on paper, Sequoia invented a way to do that too. A very remarkable feat for a single person to do that all by himself, not being literate at all, but just knowing that it could be invented. And then there was this red score, the Wollumompum, Wollum Olum, of the Lenape from around here, told something. I'll show a picture of that. But these are just pictographs. But oratory, that's not literature in a literal sense, but oratory was a very great art with Indians. To be influential, to help solve the problems of a community. It was a very highly developed art, and you still see it in many Indians. I remember hearing George Heron speak on several occasions. Now, he's a steel worker, was the chairman, was the president of the Seneca Nation several terms, and his predecessor, Cornelius Seneca, too. These men were real orators, and they could get up and make a presentation at Philadelphia Yearly Meeting, or for a Senate subcommittee, public Indian Day or something of the sort, and they'd put on an address that was, it was a work of art. I mean, this was thought out, and yet not from any notes. So that was and of course there are many orations that are in print. There are some of the books that are on the table outside, and there are several books of Indian oratory. Obviously they've been written down by somebody else who has put them into English. And obviously a great deal of the art has been lost in translation, I'm not sure, but they are recognized. There are many famous speeches that even school children are taught. There's one book on the table out there called Miracle Hill, which also comes from this Institute of American Indian Art, written by a high school boy. But apparently, it's one of these typical school exercises of write about what you did last summer, or write about your life. And this boy apparently liked doing it and did it so well that his teacher thought it ought to be published. I'm sure she must have cleaned it up as far as spelling is concerned, but she didn't clean it up as far as grammar and sentence structure was concerned. It's a very non-standard. But it's no trouble to read it. I mean, you can read it rapidly and easily, and there's no uncertainty as to what he's saying or what he means. It's a delightful book of this Navajo boy and his family life, his autobiography. There's a great deal of poetry appearing now. I laid out some papers on the table also. The Akwesasne Notes always has a page or two or three of poetry. A great deal of poetry comes out of this Institute of American Indian Art. The young people are writing a lot of poetry. I have one here which I think is really something, just a newspaper came out a few weeks ago, but I think it's very Indian. It's not great poetry, but I think he says something. I am Anishinaabe, that means Indian. I sing the songs of this land. When I hear the drum throb its voice of unity, I am one with all about me. I am Anishinaabe. I sing the songs of the earth, sky, moon, and water. For earth is my mother and the sun is my father. I am Anishinaabe. I am woven into the sacred circle of brotherhood. I am nephew to the stars, keeper of old wisdoms. I am Anishinaabe. I have heard the stillness of the full moon sky. I have greeted morning star. I am cousin to the wind. Wolf has counseled me in ways of night. I have sung and prayed for daybreak. And it goes on. Indians have had a way of making song a very important part of their lives. If you ever read that very fine short novel, When the Legends Die by Hal Borland, you know how the principal character in the story has a song to sing at every event, when the sun rises, before he goes to bed, before going hunting, every sort of an occasion. Death of his father, sings a song. Reminds me of something I heard just the other day. I wish I could quote it. But somebody said it was some of the first words in Bernstein's The Messiah. Anybody know what the words are? Something about sing God a simple song, make the words up as you go along. Sing it like you like to sing, something like that. I have it wrong, I'm sure, but the spirit of the same spirit of making song a part of your life, and we do very little of it, I'm afraid, at least I do. Well, a lot of autobiographies have been appearing. and many anthologies. A lot of the white people are really getting on the bandwagon and putting out anthologies of American Indian literature. Seems to be the popular thing, and several of them lie on the table out there. They're getting sophisticated about the kind of things they write, like Mamaday's Housemaid of Dawn, and the book by his mother, who incidentally has the same name. The mother and son have the same identical name. I forget the first name. But they have the same name identically. N. Scott Mamaday, and I forget what the N stands for. He calls himself N. Scott Mamaday, and she uses the full word of the N. She has a book of some of her own and some of his and some other Indian things. Vine Deloria is writing a great deal, and more as a lawyer, as a problem solver, about current events. But then more recently, this God is Red, which I think has a lot to say, some of which won't mean much to many of the people who ought to read it. If you're interested in Indians, you may be interested in the whole thing, because some of it is just brings you up to date on Indian problems. But the theological part, to which the title really addresses itself, I think theologians and people interested in religion ought to read, because it's a very fresh viewpoint, I think. Just as Indian is a very fresh viewpoint in art. And many people in Europe, I think, are realizing this more than we Americans are. That if they're looking for something fresh in art, the American Indian is it. The other aspects of our art one can see in Europe or elsewhere, but African or American Indian art is our fresh resources. Darcy McNichol has written several things, novels, and as well as more anthropological things and interpretive. Jack Forbes is an Indian, Rappahannock Indian on the West Coast, college professor who's written historical things. Kirk Kickingbird, written things about Indian law and treaty and history. There are quite a number of younger Indians coming along writing very well. And I'll quote one more thing before showing some slides, written by Joseph Epes Brown, who I think was in residence here at Pendle Hill at one time. At least he wrote Pendle Hill pamphlet 135 called The Spiritual Heritage of the American Indian. He says, "Even today, amid their lives of often great material poverty, there is still found in the rhythm of their society and in the beauty of the forms of their ancient culture, those great qualities for want of which the modern world is becoming impoverished in spite of its material wealth." I think many Indians think that we're very much impoverished because we don't have a rootedness, we don't have a belonging that they have. Well, we'll see what